This invasion by ICE is not making anyone in America safer. And if we don't put a stop to it, these masked agents are going to kill more people.
Yep, she's right. That's Elizabeth Warren. I think she's a no on the funding bill.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us. Welcome back to the Bradcast, celebrating this week our 22nd anniversary of listener and reader supported troublemaking and muckraking journalism over your public airwaves and at bradblog.com, where we have now officially begun our 23rd year, thanks to you folks who stopped by and hit a donate button there. As we go to air today, in the wake of now two murders of U.S. citizens by federal immigration officials in Minneapolis, apparently that has stiffened the resolve of Senate Democrats to insist that new restrictions be placed on DHS and ICE before they will approve a new funding bill for that agency. That, as we will discuss with my guests shortly, is likely to result in, yes, another partial government shutdown at the end of this week. We will have more on that with former White House Office of Management and Budget Advisor Bobby Kogan momentarily. Also in related matters, the great Bruce Springsteen has released a new song called Streets of Minneapolis that Desi Doyen was sharp enough to catch today. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
I want to have time to share that with you in full today, if possible, at the end of the show. So pardon me if I'm quicker here than usual on everything else before we get to our guest, who I will ask not just about the mechanics of what is going on in Congress for these funding bills, but the politics and risks associated with Democrats forcing another government shutdown in a midterm election year, just months after the longest one in history back in October and November.
Yep. Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of leverage there, but it seems like they're trying to do what they can
now. I think there is some leverage.
You think?
Yeah, I do. And we'll talk about that momentarily. But speaking of elections, there were a couple of special elections on Tuesday in Minnesota, of all places, the first special election since the killing of 37-year-old ICU nurse Alex Preddy and 37-year-old mother of three Renee Good in Minneapolis just a couple of weeks earlier, both U.S. citizens executed in the streets of Minneapolis while peacefully attempting to bear witness to Donald Trump's federal invasion of their great city under the premise of an immigration crackdown. Both elections on Tuesday were in the heavily Democratic Twin Cities area and were to decide partisan control of the Minnesota House of Representatives, as reported by local NBC affiliate WSLS. Going into Tuesday, Republicans held a 67-65 advantage in the chamber in the House of State House of Reps, after two Democratic representatives were elected to other offices last November. That's what these two special elections were for. The chamber has been operating since then under a power-sharing agreement between the two parties for much of the last year. In one of the districts east of St. Paul on Tuesday, Democrat Shelley Buck ran unopposed. But in District 64A, the nominees were Democrat Meg Luger-Nicolai and Republican Dan Walsh. Luger-Nicolai is a labor attorney who represented a statewide teachers union. Ooh, the dreaded teachers union. Walsh, on the other hand, runs a real estate property management company. He was the GOP nominee for this same seat back in 2022 and 2024, so you might have some name recognition there, even though it is a heavily Democratic-leaning district that Kamala Harris won in 2024 by, ready for this, 71 points.
Wow.
That's what Kamala Harris won by. That district is entirely within Ramsey County. It stretches most of the distance between St. Paul and Minneapolis. Well, on Tuesday night, in what some are describing as a referendum on the Trump regime, especially what they're doing in the Twin Cities, the Democrat Luger Nicolai didn't just win by 71 points, as Kamala Harris did in 2024. She defeated her Republican opponent on Tuesday night by 91 points.
That seems like a lot.
She took more than 95% of the vote overall, compared to Walsh's just over 4%. He had previously lost that district. I said he ran for the last couple of elections. He lost in 22 and 24 with gaining 15 and 17% of the vote, respectively, over those 2 years. But on Tuesday, he won just over 4% of the vote, 4.36% to be accurate. So that is a 20-point shift toward the Democrats in the Twin Cities area, outpacing the average 13-point shift that we have seen in the direction of Democrats in election after election over the past year since Trump took office for a second time. So when considering what's going on in Congress and who should be most concerned about being blamed for another government shutdown as of Friday night? Well, we will discuss that with our guest momentarily. And in other election news today, if this can even be considered election news at this point, you decide. The FBI executed a search warrant on the elections warehouse of Georgia's most populous county on Wednesday, seeking ballots from the 2020 election. The 2020 election, the latest apparent move, according to Washington Post, in President Donald Trump's campaign to find widespread voter fraud from that election, despite 5 years of debunked claims and dozens of dismissed court cases. An FBI spokesperson confirmed its agents were, in fact, executing a court-authorized law enforcement action at the Fulton County Elections Warehouse. Fulton County includes the bulk of Atlanta. But the spokesperson declined to provide more details. Fulton County Clerk of Courts Shea Alexander told the Post that agents were seeking 2020 ballots. The warrant sought, quote, election-related records from 2020 tied to allegations of voter fraud. Whose allegations of voter fraud? In December, the Trump Justice Department sued Fulton County, said it needed to investigate, quote, compliance with federal election law. The lawsuit demanded election officials turn over, quote, all used and void ballots, stubs of all ballots, signature envelopes, and corresponding envelope digital files from the 2020 general election in Fulton County. Under federal law, all election materials need to be retained for 22 months, but because of Donald Trump's pretend claims here, a judge has ruled that those ballots and all the material be stored indefinitely. They are apparently somewhere in that warehouse in Fulton County. It's unclear whether Wednesday's actions is connected specifically to that lawsuit, but it sure sounds like it is. A DOJ spokesperson declined to comment. Fulton County, of course, became a national epicenter of baseless election fraud allegations in January of 2021, the Post reports, when Trump, on a phone call, tried to persuade Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, to, quote, find enough votes, more than 11,000 of them, to reverse Joe Biden's narrow victory in the state that year. As the New York Times reports this afternoon, Josh McLaurin a Democratic state senator who arrived at the scene on Wednesday afternoon, said, quote, "This is extremely alarming. This is an order from on high," he said, "to try to disrupt Fulton County's election administration just because Donald Trump is still mad that he lost the 2020 election." It also comes on the heels of FBI Director Kash Patel last week forcing out the head of the FBI Bureau's Atlanta office, though it's unclear whether the ouster was related to Wednesday's search, the Times said, but I'm going to bet that it was. He said, no, this is absurd. And Cash said, well, Mr. Trump told me to fire you in that case. Just guessing. In October, Harmeet Dhillon, the far-right Republican activist and conspiracy theorist who now runs the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, subpoenaed Fulton County's 2020 ballots, but the county resisted turning them over. As part of its civil lawsuit in December, the DOJ accused county officials of violating the Civil Rights Act by not handing over those ballots. Because, you know, the Trump administration is really concerned about the civil rights of voters in Atlanta. Earlier this month, Trump vowed to arrest people in connection with what he claimed was voter fraud in 2020, saying, quote, "People will soon be prosecuted for what they did," he said. Some discrepancies, in fact, in Fulton County's recount process did emerge after the 2020 election, as we've detailed several times on this program over the many years since then. But the state's Republican leadership ultimately affirmed Biden's victory there. Nonetheless, despite repeated explanations from top election officials, Fulton County has remained an obsession among right-wing election activists who still believe the county counted fraudulent ballots to swing the election to Mr. Biden. They just have not been able to find any evidence of any yet. We'll see what they find now. A Georgia grand jury indicted Donald Trump himself and his associates on racketeering charges, you'll recall, back in August of 2023 over their alleged efforts to steal the election in the state. But the case was eventually subsumed by allegations that the lead prosecutor, Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis, had an inappropriate relationship with a special prosecutor on her team. The case was dismissed after a new prosecutor took over the matter. In response to that dismissal, Trump vowed on social media to, quote, "hold responsible those who perpetuated the witch hunt against him." There was, of course, no witch hunt against him. He got off the hook, in fact, for trying to steal the state's 2020 election. Trump himself, however, has been carrying out a number of witch hunts. Under Trump, the DOJ has sued several states, including Georgia, demanding that they turn over large volumes of voter data. Several federal judges have tossed out those lawsuits, most recently this week in Oregon, as we reported yesterday. As Reuters notes, however, a succession of people who have criticized Trump or resisted his agenda have in fact found themselves investigated by the DOJ, led by his corrupt Attorney General Pam Bondi over the past year. The department unsuccessfully tried to prosecute former FBI Director James Comey, New York State Attorney General Letitia James, who both led previous investigations into Trump. It also brought charges against Trump's former National Security Advisor, John Bolton, a prominent Trump critic. It's opened investigations into 9 Democratic lawmakers so far that we know of. A former CIA director, the Federal Reserve chair who has resisted Trump's pressure to lower interest rates. So that is today's madness to help distract you from the Trump administration's various and many crimes, his own personal crimes, and of course, yes, the Epstein files. Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
But for now, speaking of Trump administration crimes, let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with Bobby Kogan on the latest shutdown showdown in Congress, this time over funding for Trump's deadly ICE operation, as Democrats are now standing up to say, nope, they're not going to play along anymore, at least until ICE is reined in, or so they say. All that straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Hey, this is Desi. The Bradcast and the Green News Report survive thanks to you and your support. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate today to help us stay independent every day over your public airwaves. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Oh, don't you wish that was Chuck Schumer's theme song? Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Maybe a bunch of Democrats, including Schumer, are singing that song today. We will find out in the next few hours and days, I suspect. But let me start here for the moment. Department of Homeland Security officers, including Customs and Border Patrol, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, etc., have fired shots during enforcement arrests or at people protesting their operations 16 times since July of last year, according to Washington Post on Tuesday. And as in the three recent shootings in Minneapolis, in each case, the Trump administration has publicly declared their actions justified before even waiting for any investigation to be completed. Most of the incidents involved officers firing at drivers during enforcement stops in cities like Los Angeles and Chicago, where DHS has surged federal immigration officers. At least 10 people have been struck by bullets fired by U.S. government officials, including four U.S. citizens. Three of those people have been killed by those federal government agents. The shootings have sparked alarm, particularly of late, following the killings in Minneapolis of U.S. citizens Renee Good and Alex Preti, not only due to their violence, but also for the Trump administration's response to the shootings. Lawyers say officials have been quick to pursue felony charges against those fired at. Though in four of 10 cases so far, prosecutors have either dropped charges ultimately or a judge has dismissed them after evidence emerged completely contradicting the government's narrative of events. None of the officers from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, U.S. Border Patrol, or Homeland Security investigations to date has faced any criminal charges in any of the shootings, nor has the administration announced any internal disciplinary measures against them. And yet, amid all of that, the media verdict is in. President Trump has, quote, softened his stance on his paramilitary war on Minneapolis, according to PBS. He struck a, quote, cooperative tone in a call with Minnesota's Democratic Governor Tim Walz, the New York Times reports. The administration hopes to, quote, shift its strategy on its ICE raids, the paper dutifully reported, as Trump is executing a, quote, pivot and is attempting to, quote, de-escalate, reports Axios. You get the idea, argues the National Review's Greg Sargent today. Trump is chastened by the backlash to the ICE murders of Alex Preti and Renee Good, so he's now recalibrating the government's approach in an effort to appear to dial down the violent social conflict that has been unleashed. But the New York Times also reports that, well, Trump met with Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem for 2 hours amid supposed, quote, concern about the shootings. Nonetheless, they report Noem's job is still safe. Nothing to worry about. Trump has replaced the public face of the Minneapolis occupation by removing Border Patrol Chief Gregory Bovino, who swaggers around these scenes of occupation like a conquering general, writes Sargent. He's been replaced with border czar Tom Homan, who swaggers around on Fox News like a conquering general. So has anything really changed? What's really going on here is this, Sargent argues, with some evidence to back him up. Trump is looking to defuse anger among congressional Democrats for purposes that don't portend a meaningful shift. In fact, an administration official gave away the game to Punchbowl News, admitting that these so-called de-escalatory measures are actually about placating Senate Democrats so they don't seize this moment to demand restrictions on ICE as part of any government funding package. the latest of which has a deadline of this Friday at midnight, or the government will once again shut down. Just months after what became the longest partial federal government shutdown in U.S. history, just last October and November. As we reported earlier in this week, after months of bipartisan negotiations by House and Senate appropriators, and after the House has already narrowly passed what they call a so-called minibus bill, a measure that combines five separate spending bills that the House also previously passed into one single bill for theoretically easy passage in the Senate, House Speaker Mike Johnson then sent the House home for a week-long recess, even as the Senate was left to grapple with that bill, a bill that they would need to pass as is without changing a word, since that would require another vote in the U.S. House, but the House would not be available to do so before Friday's deadline because they have all been sent home. Still, it looked like there would be enough Democratic votes in the U.S. Senate. Just seven are needed to join all 53 Republicans to overcome the Senate's 60-vote threshold to avoid a filibuster. That's what it looked like last week, at least until the second murder of a U.S. citizen in Minneapolis by federal immigration agents over the past weekend. As we noted on Monday, Senate Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer announced on Saturday night, after the killing of Veterans Affairs Intensive Care Unit nurse Alex Preddy, that Democrats in the Senate, quote, would not provide the votes for a government funding bill unless appropriations for the Department of Homeland Security included new guidelines for ICE. In his statement describing the violence by federal agents in Minnesota as, quote, appalling and, quote, unacceptable in any American city, Schumer said that, quote, Democrats sought common sense reforms in the DHS spending bill, but because of Republicans' refusal to stand up to President Trump, the DHS bill, he said, is woefully inadequate to rein in the abuses of ICE, adding that he would vote no and that, quote, Senate Democrats will not provide the votes to proceed to the appropriations bill if the DHS funding bill is included in it. So if I understand this correctly, no approval for the DHS funding bill, which has been shackled by the House vote to four other funding bills, none of which can pass as a unit without approval of the DHS funding bill, unless House members somehow return to vote on a measure passed by the Senate, whatever measure they may pass, before Friday night, when the government will once again shut down for lack of funding if they don't. And even if somehow, as I understand it, the DHS funding bill were to be separated out, well, that would still leave other agencies funded in the same bill, like the U.S. Coast Guard, the TSA, as well as FEMA and the Disaster Relief Fund, as the U.S. is coming out of a major deadly winter storm, without funding either. And while Democratic appropriators who had previously supported the DHS spending bill in both the House and Senate noted there are some new guardrails contained in that DHS bill, like a few million dollars for more body cams, even if the $10 billion DHS bill for 2026 is blocked, the agency will keep operating. They already have more than enough money to continue. And without those minor guardrails that would be included in this new bill, thanks to the $75 billion slush fund that Republicans created for DHS in Donald Trump's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill last summer. All of this, quite the pickle, it seems to me, though Democrats appear ready to stand their ground, I think, to block the funding measure without substantive reforms to ICE, which, yes, would not only have to be approved in the Senate, but also approved before Friday at midnight by the currently absent U.S. House. So do I have this right? And if so, what now? Is there any way out of this mess? And do Democrats have the courage to take the heat if it comes with another government shutdown over all of this? Joining us now to try and make sense of all of this, a man who knows quite a bit about passing budgets through Congress against great odds, Bobby Kogan, served in the Biden White House as advisor to the director of the Office of Management and Budget. Before that, he served as chief mathematician and head of budget analysis for the U.S. Senate Budget Committee under both Senators Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Democratic Senator Patty Murray of Washington, who I believe is currently the lead Democratic appropriations negotiator. Oh, Bobby Kogan, welcome back, sir, to the broadcast.
Brad, thank you so much for having me back on.
So first, there was a lot of details there to try and tie together in that introduction. Did I get my explainer mostly correct as far as congressional budget politics go and as we see them at this hour?
Yeah, I might have quibbled with a tiny bit, but I think everything you were saying, it leaves people with the correct impression, which is that we are barreling towards a shutdown unless something changes. We're going to look at a six-bill shutdown, as you said, right? The issue now is that we have the DHS bill going alongside defense, labor, HHS, education, foreign affairs, financial services and general government, and transportation, housing, and urban development. Those five, I know it sounded like more than five bills, but those are five bills. Plus DHS, that's what's on the hook here. Democrats say, well, listen, we can't pass DHS without meaningful changes. Let's pass the other five right now, and then we can figure out DHS as we figure it out. And the current Republican position is absolutely not. Obviously, things could change now. I would say the politics of this are changing every single day. I think you're totally right about the current state of politics. And by the time this airs, it could be different. But 12 hours from now, it could be different. 24 hours from now, it could be different. That's where we're looking, right? Republicans say, no, absolutely not. We're not going to pass the other ones. Democrats say, well, we're not going to pass DHS, so we're looking at a shutdown.
Well, even if they did take that bill out, they took the DHS bill out and passed the rest of them, even if Republicans agreed to go along with that, that would still require the House to come back into session before Friday night to avoid another shutdown, right?
Yeah, that's of course right, and a lot of them are not in D.C. And as you know, there's a lot of lots of snow all over the country that are delaying a lot of things. I think we're looking at a shutdown to this point. That's why there's so much consternation over in the Senate. They are desperately trying to find a way to get promises to pass the version as is, but you can understand why. Pinky promises from the administration that it's busy executing U.S. citizens is going to be insufficient.
Like a promise, for example, sure, we'll work with you on some restrictions on ICE. As long as you pass this bill now, we'll get to those later. Kind of like the way they the last shutdown back in October, November, they said, well, go ahead, vote along with us, and we'll let you have a vote on your Affordable Care Act subsidies, but it was essentially meaningless. And if, Bobby, the Senate were to simply pass a continuing resolution, they say, well, we can't get this worked out for the moment. Let's just pass a CR to keep the government open. The House would still have to come back to approve that CR as well.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. The options are pass this exactly as is, or change it. And if you're changing it, then that means the House needs to come back in. The president needs to be willing to sign it. Things are obvious. There's just not very much time to make that happen. And again, the politics are really meaningful, right? Like we are looking at the fact that the U.S. government is doing drive-by pepper sprays, is going door-to-door without warrants, is shoving elderly folks, is beating up and executing detained people, and then destroying evidence and lying about it. And there's not much leverage that the Democratic Party has because it is in the minority. You could have every single Democrat vote affirmatively in favor of a change that would be good. But unless you get enough Republicans in both chambers and the president on board, it's not going to happen. So there's just not that much you can do, but you have to try. You have to try because what else can you possibly do? There's not much leverage. But you must try. This is one of the few must-pass bills that still exist. If you don't pass it, the government shuts down. And government shutdowns cannot go on for forever because eventually everything starts to break. So it's only a little bit of leverage, but you got to use it.
Yeah, make no mistake. This is leverage. I mean, they actually have something here that they can use, and they were going to not use it, it seemed to me, until what happened last weekend with Alex Pretty. And they said, hey, wait a minute, this has gone too far. and we do have some leverage. Let's use it here. It seems to me that Mike Johnson used this same strategy last time, sending the House home, voting for a bill that he was able to get through the House with Republican votes, and then sending everyone home. So this sort of no way out strategy, leaving it to the Senate, they must pass the bill as is. Is that fair to say that that's exactly why he did that?
That's right. It's a super common strategy for one chamber to do something and then leave and jam the other chamber. Mm-hmm. And of course, like last time, the Senate jammed the House with that provision that was going to allow only senators in the Jan 6 probe to sue and get millions of dollars.
Yes.
And it's not just like if you're a part of Jan 6, it's only the senators who could do it. And so they, you know, they did that. They jammed the House, and the House was looking at it and saying, do we want to be the reason that like we don't open back up? And now on the flip side, in the House version, they did a unanimous removal and they sent it back to the Senate. Anyway, so it's a common thing for one chamber to jam the other chamber. There's a cool quote that is, you know, from the House that's like decades old. It's older than Gephardt, though Gephardt, I think, popularized it, where he says, no, the Republicans are the opposition party. The true enemy is the Senate. The chambers hate each other, but they love to jam each other.
I see what they're doing there. All right. Well, before we get to the possibilities where all of this could go in the coming days, Bobby Kogan, last time we spoke, I think, was with you last year. I think it was on the first day that the government shut down when Democrats were demanding the restoration of the Affordable Care Act subsidies. And then for reasons that are still unclear to me, about 43 days later, they eventually got enough Senate Democrats to agree to vote with Republicans, and the government was finally reopened after the longest shutdown in history. At the time, Democrats had some worry that they would be blamed for that shutdown by voters. But the American people clearly blamed Trump and the Republicans more than the Democrats. And I believe it was the very next day after Democrats agreed to reopen the government, the very next day, there was a blue tidal wave in off-year elections in Virginia, in New Jersey, just about everywhere else. So suggesting Democrats paid no cost, in fact, for that shutdown. Did the Democrats, as far as you can tell, learn anything about their premature capitulation last time that can be applied to this current matter?
You know, I hope so. I always say everyone gets hurt in a shutdown, but one side gets hurt more. I think Democrats did pay a political price, but I think Republicans paid a much bigger political price. So in the binary, it effectively works that, you know, Republicans were the one who paid a price, right? The popularity goes down. You poll, you look at the blame. Lots of people were pissed, but they were more pissed at the other side. The issue behind the shutdown is that real people are affected, right? And so my take on what happened was the SNAP payments, you know, there was a problem with the SNAP payments at the very end. And you even had like, you know, Senator Warnock was like one of the, like strongest kind of like spoken advocates for the subsidies. He said, you know, we owe it to people to make sure that they can have their health. And at the very end, he said, I don't know how I'm supposed to weigh people getting food against people getting healthcare. And those were, you know, he said, I don't know how I'm supposed to do this. And that was a real worry at the end. I would say the reason we have leverage here is that shutdowns are bad, and the longer they go on, the worse they get. So just to give one example, if we began a shutdown on January 31st, and it ran until April 1st, that's a long shutdown, that would be the longest in U.S. history. But if we went until April 1st, SSI payments would stop, right? Payments for people, you know, Americans with disabilities that can't work and, you know, are relying on SSI. These folks who are already, you know, barely scraping by because SSI payments are so restrictive and, you know, blah, 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 blah. If those SSI payments stopped, we would talk about further impoverishing some of the most vulnerable Americans on the planet. Now, it is also really important to make sure Americans are not executed in the street, right? But like the whole point is that shutdowns are painful for everyone involved, politically, both sides, and the people who are missing services. Mm-hmm. And the longer a shutdown goes on, the more and more and more people are starting to feel the pain. And so everyone starts to get scared. And it's a game of chicken because we don't actually want to hurt the people that we're trying to help.
Exactly. In the meantime, I know you're in touch with folks in Congress. Are there, in fact, enough Democrats, as Schumer's statement would suggest, enough Dems who are willing to vote no to a DHS ICE funding bill that does not include new reforms to actually prevent the passage of this measure?
Yeah, as of today, we are looking at a six-bill shutdown. The most likely outcome is that all six of those bills that I mentioned, DHS and the other five, we enter a shutdown on the 31st.
And Republicans don't want to separate that out because they want those other bills to not pass, to increase the cost of the pain, they think, to Democrats.
Yeah, the party in charge traditionally is against separating bills, right? When Democrats were in charge in the Obama administration, we were staring at shutdown. You know, we obviously had a shutdown. We were staring at other ones. The Obama position was, we're not separating off. The worry always is the less and less and less and less of the government that is shut down, the smaller the constituency for reopening. And so there's always a worry that one will never reopen, which obviously, you know, that's the Republican worry for DHS. I don't think it's very realistic because there are parts of DHS that are like TSA and FEMA, right? Like there are parts of DHS that like we, the United States government, wouldn't want to have, like no matter what your position is, you don't want FEMA to go away. No matter what your position is, you don't want the entire airport, you know, system to stop.
You would think that about FEMA, by the way, Bobby, but I mean, they've been cutting FEMA to the bone. They only stopped firing people because it was like, oh, look, there's a winter storm bearing down in half the country.
Yeah.
It doesn't look too good to be firing people amid the storm.
Yeah. As an aside, that's like, it's so funny. The White House and some congressional Republicans use that as an, oh my God, Dems are looking to shut down the government. Can you believe what would happen to FEMA then? And not only were they wrong, because FEMA has a lot of money, but it's the same organization that they have enormous backlogs in, where they're very famously not doling out the money. And it's super hypocritical.
Exactly. So what kind of reforms, as you understand it, amid all of this CBP and ICE carnage at this point, what sort of reforms would allow Democrats at this point to vote to give still more money, $10 billion in the current bill, to ICE, even though they already received $75 billion in last year's so-called big, beautiful bill, and they could keep operating for years without any funding bill, it seems?
Yeah, TBD. Dems are having another meeting today. They're trying to figure out, they're trying to get caucus-wide agreement. There are some. Some of them are pretty good. Some of them are pretty insufficient. Some of them are basically restating current law, right? Like, so what do they want? They want body-worn cameras. Mm-hmm. They want no more masks, and they want identification, right? Obviously, if you are not wearing a mask and you have identification, you can still go murder people. But I think there is a belief among people that part of the reason these folks act with impunity is that they think they will never be identified. And I do think that there is some truth to that. I think there will still be tons of carnage if you get that, but I think that that's a directionally good thing. They want cooperation with local, with states and localities, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, it's a big problem where they go and they destroy the evidence and they say other folks can't conduct their own investigations. So it's another way of them getting away with their stuff. Obviously, they'll still continue to do bad things, but the more they think they can get away with it, the more they think they'll do it. They want requiring DOJ civil rights reviews, reiterating the Fourth Amendment obligations, right? That's one of the jokes where it's like, well, you can't, if you're already breaking the law, you can't make them follow the law. But as they say, you know, these ones are pretty tough.
Well, they can require judicial warrants, which are theoretically already required, but they can they can restate that.
Exactly. Totally. And some of this, you know, requires theoretical buy-in from folks as well, right? That's the example. But part of the issue is that the DHS authorization law it is like one of the most flexible and permissive of all of them, right? It was created in the response to 9/11, where we were just we were giving ludicrous amounts of power to the executive. Mm-hmm. And so if you go through, I think there are arguments to be made for huge amounts of flexibility where one part of the law says you can't do this and another part of the law grants emergency powers if you declare an emergency and the president declares an emergency, blah, blah, blah. So cleaning up some of that to kind of make sure that they can't do loopholes is a really good thing. I think obviously Dems are going to ask for, you know, Kristi Noem to be ousted. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily change anything, but it could. And then the only other thing that I would mention is, so we've been, I'm glad you've been lifting up all this money from the big, beautiful bill.
Yeah.
Going after and rescinding some of that money, there's no way we'll get it all in one fell swoop, but getting some of that removed, I think, is a good step. We gave money to the IRS and the Inflation Reduction Act from the Biden administration, and as soon as Republicans retook power, they made removing that money the cost of doing business. And they didn't get it all in the first year or the second year the third year, but they got it. They got like 20 some billion in the first year. You got another 10 some billion in the second, another 20 some billion in the second year. And then there, you know, more money this year. They've just been really ravaging this money. And I think we should be doing the same. I think that money gives the Trump administration more flexibility and makes them less beholden mm-hmm. to Congress and to the appropriations cycle. Right. And so removing that makes them more beholden to these, to the appropriations process.
Rescinding at least some portion of it.
Exactly.
But along with all of these other things, I mean, you know, never mind getting this passed before Friday, before a government shutdown. I mean, do you have a sense that, you know, Donald Trump says, oh, we want to take down the temperature. We're going to, relook at things. And the media is going along with this idea that, oh, maybe Republicans realize it's all gone too far. You've got some Republicans, notably Tom Tillis, who is leaving government at the end of this year. Murkowski, who always seems to vote these days against her own party. Is there really an appetite on the Republican side to go along with any of these reforms, or do they just want to get this passed and get beyond it and hope people forget about it by November?
I think I'm ready to be wrong. I think the most likely outcome is another high up person in DHS loses their job. Could be Kristi Noem, could be someone else. And I think we get some very modest reforms. I think the most likely outcome is those two things as a team, because I do think some Republicans are unhappy. And I think one of the unspoken things here is that some of them are worried about mob violence against themselves for going against Trump. But I do think there are some Republicans who are genuinely a little aghast at US citizens being executed. This is, when you look at the Republican responses here, I have not seen anything like this since January 6th in terms of Republicans speaking out against the Trump administration. Obviously, it's all tepid, it's all lukewarm, it's all, you know, it's all somewhat hedged. But normally, you see something that in any other era of an American history would cause the president and the entire cabinet to resign. And it's just another Thursday. And no one responds. And in fact, they defend it. And this is one of the few times where you've seen like a third of the party say, whoa, there's something bad here. I know it feels very minor. But again, I cannot. The last time I saw something like this was Jan 6,
yeah,
and I don't remember another time other than that. So I think that speaks to something real, and that's why I think we will probably get something. I think it will be far insufficient, and I think ICE and CBP will continue to exist as secret police that like that execute Americans and beat people up on the street and pepper spray. I think we'll continue to have a really bad thing, but I think that we will get some reforms that will do something directionally.
As I recall, last time we spoke with you, Bobby, about the shutdown over healthcare, over Obamacare, if I'm remembering correctly, I had asked you, is this the right thing to shut down for? And if I recall, you said, you know, if not this, then what? In a similar vein, is this the right thing to shut it down for? And if so, and if it's only, you know, tepid reforms that are offered, should Democrats, in fact, you know, go to the mattresses here? And I mean, you know, Americans are being shot dead in the streets by federal officials. I don't know, you know, if this is popular on any side of the aisle. Is this something else that they should just hang in there as long as they can and get as much as they can? Or should they accept any sort of tepid reforms that they're offered by Republicans here?
This is the right thing to shut down the government for. Let's be completely clear. There is nothing more quintessential than fighting government oppression. There is nothing more quintessential. I am the person who goes out and says, foundation of society is shelter, food, and healthcare. Right? I'm the person who says that's the quintessential thing. But actually, not being assassinated by, or executed by the government is the most quintessential thing. Not being executed by the government for existing and just filming them, that's the most quintessential thing. This is the thing that you have to shut down the government over. Will it work? I don't know. Democrats owe it to the American people to do the very best they can. Democrats owe it to the American people to do the best they can. And it's impossible to predict, but they owe it to the American people to give it their all, because it's not just the political whims or whatever that matters. It matters to real people, and it matters to history, right? Like, I feel so lame saying, oh, it matters to history, but it really matters, right? Like, yep. How we respond to this is going to shape what we are as a nation. And so Democrats owe it to the American people to give it their all.
This really does feel like a turning point, but we've felt a lot of turning points that didn't end up being turning points at all. Let's hope this is the case here. Bobby, I know you've got you posted a short thread earlier in the week about a new paper you got coming out next week at American Progress on how much the fiscal outlook has now deteriorated under Donald Trump. You know, much of which is due to the higher deficits, thanks to the Trump Republican tax cuts. That paper's coming out next week. But on a similar vein, do shutdowns like the one that we saw last October, November, like the one that we could see coming up now, do they actually cost the government anything in the bargain, or do they actually save the government money, as, you know, Republicans used to like to claim? Oh, they didn't mind the government was shut down when they were the ones shutting it down, because it saves taxpayer money, stuff we're not spending. Does it actually save money or cost the taxpayers money when we do these shutdowns?
It doesn't save money, because you got to spend the money when you open back up. And the way to think about it is, if you miss a rent payment, and let's just pretend there's no penalty for a hot second. If you miss your rent payment, then you got to pay it and the next month's rent the next time, right? So if you just kind of stop making payments, then when you open back up, you got to do all the payments that are due. So it doesn't save any money. It doesn't cost money insofar as Congress appropriated a certain amount of money, so you're going to use that amount of money, unless you're illegally impounding it. But it is super inefficient. You get less bang for your buck, because lots of times there are fees associated with being late, or you shut everything down, you have to open everything back up, you kind of paused all your operations, then you got to get going again. There are costs to kind of the inertia involved in this. So in terms of the total dollars spent, it's the same whether you have a shutdown or not. When you have a shutdown, it leads to less efficient government spending, but it's at the margin.
Gotcha.
You can't have a shutdown for forever, because eventually everything breaks. When you open back up, you've been less efficient. But shutdowns are fundamentally political tools. It's when the two parties can't agree on what and how we should be using our money. And right now, the two parties can't agree on whether we should be using our money to execute our own citizens.
Yes.
That's the disagreement in this one. And a little bit of inefficiency is a small price to pay to win that debate.
Before I let you go, I've got and I won't hold you to this unless I decide to and have you come back next week and tell you you were wrong. But any predictions, any sense of what is actually likely to happen here based on your conversations with the appropriations committee folks, et cetera, what are we going to see moving forward?
Yeah, I'm ready to be wrong, but I do think the most likely outcome is a sixth bill shutdown, not just DHS, but those other five bills. I don't know how long it'll last. I think we're walking out of this with one more head on the platter and with some reforms that are not super duper large. And so I think it just, the only question is how long it takes to get all of that. I could be wrong, but based on my conversations with Dems, they are not at a place to accept a pinky promise from the administration doing this all. And there simply isn't enough time to get everything done. And even if there were enough time to get the other five bills done, there isn't enough time for everyone to agree on what the DHS stuff is. As they say, Dems hope to figure out what their unified ask is, and then you'd have to come up with language and get it all through. So I think we're looking at a shutdown. I just don't know how long.
I think we are too. Bobby Cogan is the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress. You can find his work over there, AmericanProgress.org. He was the former advisor to the Director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Biden White House. And the head of budget analysis in the U.S. Senate for some time. You can find him also on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at BB Cogan. Bobby, always a delight speaking with you, sir, and it may be sooner rather than later, given what's going on now when we shout for you next. Thank you, brother.
Brad, thank you so much for having me back on. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, sir. All right. Well, we do not have time for a break, Desi, because I want to get straight to this.
Yep.
The great Bruce Springsteen posted a new song on his Blue Sky feed on Wednesday, noting that he said, quote, "I wrote this song on Saturday. That would be the day that Alex Pretty was killed. Recorded it yesterday and release it to you today," he says, in response to the state terror being visited on the city of Minneapolis. It's dedicated, he says, to the people of Minneapolis, our innocent immigrant neighbors, and in memory of Alex Pretty and Renee Good, adding, "Stay free."
Through the winter's ice and cold, down Nicollet Avenue, a city of flame fought fire and ice neath an occupier's boots. King Trump's private army from the DHS, guns belted to their coats, came to Minneapolis to enforce the law, or so their story goes. Against smoke and rubber bullets, in the dawn's early light, citizens stood for justice, their voices ringing through the night. And there were bloody footprints where mercy should have stood, and two dead left to die on snow-filled streets, Alex Pretty and Renee. I hear your voice singing through the bloody mist. We'll take our stand for this land and the stranger in our midst. Here in our home they killed and roamed in the winter of 26. We'll remember the names of those who died on the streets of Minneapolis. Trump's federal thugs beat upon his face and his chest. Then we heard the gunshots, and Alex Pretty lay in the snow dead. Their claim was self-defense, sir. Just don't believe your eyes. It's our blood and bones and these whistles and phones against Miller and Noam's dirty lies. Oh, I'm Minneapolis, I hear your voice crying through.
to die on the streets of Minneapolis. Now they say they're here to uphold the law, but they trample on our rights. If your skin is black or brown, my friend, you can be questioned or deported on sight. In our chains of
ICE out now,
our city's heart and soul persist. Through broken glass and bloody tears on the streets of Minneapolis.
Ice Out Now. That was Bruce Springsteen in a brand new song called Streets of Minneapolis, released this afternoon, dedicated to the people of Minneapolis, our innocent immigrant neighbors, and in memory of Alex Preti and Renee Good. We will, of course, link to that song when we post today's show at brandblog.com. My thanks again to Bobby Kogan of the Center for American Progress, our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other since the beginning of time, you can download them all for free at bradblog.com. Now celebrating 22 years of troublemaking and muckraking. You can also stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, including especially Blue Sky, I am the Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.